Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are bringing you an interesting twist on our usual topic list tonight, and I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a learning opportunity for a lot of us, I have a feeling, and that's a good thing. Of course, we can't get any of that going until my co-host is brought on the show, and Sam, you're bringing us a great topic tonight. I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Yes, we all are. It's going to be a very interesting, in fact, month. I have a lot of my friends from the Public Safety Writers Association. They're all writers, and they write about their careers, and we can learn a lot about cops. But first, Miss Becky, what does the weather look like this week?
Well, at least for Jamie and I here on the East Coast, it's a bit of whiplash. We went from, you know, pretty chilly and damp last week to what's going to be very, very hot this coming weekend. Temperatures are going to be probably 15 to 25 above normal. It's just really a complete 180. And then along with that, just a chance for rain pretty much every day this week, some showers, some thunderstorms. And then unfortunately, the south, southern Gulf states, particularly over to Texas, is going to be seeing a lot of rain, and they've already had a lot of rain. So that area is so prone to flooding, and it looks like they're just going to continue to see more flooding throughout the next couple of days.
Sorry, Chris. I think that would be you in Florida.
Yes, you're
California will be dry, I assume, so our other guests won't be getting wet.
Yeah, except they may.
We just have to worry about the state burning up. Oh. That's all.
I'm up in Washington State, so.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Rain is a everyday, any day occurrence.
Yeah, you're pretty used to it. All righty. Well, we're going to jump into this because I have so many questions for these guys. Let me tell you a little bit about them, and they can elaborate. Chris Berg is a third-generation cop, starting out as a patrol officer, became an evidence technician, then a vice and intelligence detective, and undercover narcotics agent. Did you do that underwater, Chris? I don't know. I never heard of that before.
Well, we sort of felt like we could do that.
I'm sure they put some of that underwater. I don't know. Paul James Smith, he started his career at 19 and had a long career in the military as an enlisted Marine, became a local lawman, a federal agent, and the Reserve Coast Guard officer who commanded two expeditionary units and went on four deployments to the Persian Gulf. Then he became a cop and was a patrolman, a field training officer, a SWAT guy, a detective, a federal agent, a sniper and sniper instructor, and on a national tactical team as a leader. We could do a month just in that bio, Paul. That's how did you fit all that in? You must be 92 now to have done all of that.
Yeah, I did a lot of things concurrently.
Yeah, like I said, we could ask interesting questions about all of those roles. But the reason we bring you on is because you are writers, and the two of you wrote a book and have another one in the works called Night Cops, and we're going to find out what that is. But first, we want to talk a little bit about just being a cop. Obviously, it's not easy, especially in this day and age where cops are not seen in a good light by a lot of people. But, Chris, you were a third generation, so I can kind of see why you moved in that direction. But, Paul, what made you want to be a cop after you went through your military career?
Well, actually, I did my enlisted time as a Marine. I did my 4 years, and at that point, I went into law enforcement. And Chris and I were on the same agency. He was about a year ahead of me there. But I just never wanted to have an 8-to-5 office job. I remember one time being stuck in traffic as a kid and seeing all the people that were commuting, you know, home from their various offices. And I just thought to myself, that's not what I want to do. That's not what I want to be. And so I've always kind of sought out something that was not an office job.
I think we could say that about everybody on the show. But, yeah, I totally agree with that, especially after being in the military. I mean, come on. I can't see anybody having been active in the military sitting behind a desk and being happy. Chris, tell us a little bit about your three generations of cops.
Sure. Well, my father was a game warden, and I grew up in the game warden family, and that was pretty terrific. His father was a police officer in the Bay Area back in the early to mid 1900s. I became the third generation. And I guess there's a fourth generation. One of my daughter's horses ended up going to the U.S. Park Service as a police horse. So I guess really there were four generations in my family, but I personally never thought of doing anything else.
Well, good deal. So we're going to dig here a little bit into the cop psyche. I looked at some of the media information you sent me, and you talked about cops transforming from rookies to veterans and having to deal with lack of admin support, bad press, internal investigations, and court issues. Now, some of that we as medical folks might have to deal with, but not court and some of those other things, internal investigations. What's that all about? How much of that affects your job? We'll go with Paul first this time.
Well, the cops that Chris and I are, the brand of cops that we've chose to write about, we call them night policemen, and they're kind of like they're the super cops. But if you were in your home and someone was like hammering on the door or trying to break in the middle of the night, you would want a night policeman to show up, because he would take care of business. Those kinds of cops often are crossways with the administration because they are very results-driven. And, of course, we policed in a whole different era than what goes on today. I can't even imagine being a policeman today. But from time to time, because we were very results-driven, we did end up talking to the internal affairs guys about what we may or may not have done on some occasion. And then probably more importantly, as you become older and you become more of a veteran, you really—it's a hard phenomenon to explain. But you do end up very cross-purpose with the administration.
I can understand that.
Chris, jump in there, because you and I...
Yeah, Chris, I'd like to hear your definition of a night cop.
Well, for us, night policemen were really the cops that got things done. There are plenty of cops that are more than happy to put in their 40 hours a week and, stay out of anything that's dicey if they can. And then there's another type, and those are the type of people we write about, and those are the people that I always felt that those were the people that cared for the victims. Those were the people that second-guessed what was going on because they cared what happened to the victims. And there's almost nobody out there that really cares for the victims, at least that's my personal opinion. You look at the courts, you look at the press, you look at police administrations, they all have agendas, but none of those agendas are trying to do right by the victim. And so, yes, sometimes the people we write about bent the rules. And yes, sometimes we did get sideways with administration. But that was all because it was a brand of policing that was about the victims. And victims' rights are important to that brand of policeman.
So you're the victim advocate. And I think we would all agree that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely weren't that formally, but we were definitely that informally.
We saw it firsthand. Try not to be all touchy-feely, but we saw as cops, especially cops working night shift stuff, we saw the folks when they were hurting, when they'd been assaulted, when they'd been raped, when those things had, and no one else in the criminal justice system, other than, I know you all are very much in the medical field, so you probably saw a great deal of that too when you came to treat some of those people, but no one else has an understanding of what it all becomes very sterile 6-8 months down the road when it comes into the court system.
Wow. Yeah, I'm kind of envisioning some things I remember from my careers. How can you not feel for those people? I mean, as first responders, it's the cops and the EMTs and the medics that really see them when they're going through the worst of it. But that kind of brings up another similar issue. We talk a lot on this show about the effects of stress on first responders in general, the number of suicides, PTSD, coping issues. And one of the comments you made about night cops is they seem to have managed this better than some of those other cops. Is there an issue with mental health care? Are cops opposed to doing that? Do they feel it could be career limiting if they seek help? Chris, why don't you start with that one?
Yeah, the answer to that's definitely yes. I think there's lots of mental health issues for law enforcement. And I think, frankly, it's probably similar in the fire services and similar in the services that you guys came from. You see the things that that the average person just doesn't see. There is, you know, policemen in general are not warm and cuddly like firemen are, and that always used to just irritate me. But
you didn't want to be warm and cuddly?
Well, it would have been nice once in a while to, you know, for somebody to pat a policeman on the back. Having done both of those roles, police and fire, there's definitely a different world and mindset. But I do think that there are a host of mental health issues, and I think there's an unbelievable lack of support for law enforcement. I personally always felt, and maybe it's because of the type of policing we did, that the administration was much more interested in what the press thought about issues than they were about how their officers were dealing with what they saw. I mean, you know, if there's a shooting, and you watch TV today, there's a shooting, they bring in a host of psychiatrists and all of that, if there's a shooting. But there's 10,000 permutations that are short of that, where there's no psychiatrist that's brought. You know, you go to a suicide in the middle of the night, you go to a shooting, a stabbing, a rape, whatever it is. Nobody, I mean, when you're done with that call, you get back in your cruiser and you go back to work. Nobody's standing around asking you, you know, how are you feeling? Are you okay? Just doesn't work that way. Never has. I doubt it, that it's really ever going to. But I'm quite sure you guys experience the same.
Well, to be honest, I was very involved in critical incident stress management right from the gate because of some experiences I had. And when I got to Northern California, we actually started a program for AMR, which of course is a very large ambulance company. And we made sure that no incident went without at least the offer of support. So I think you know, I might stretch myself to say I think EMS is a little bit better on this, but I know with bigger incidents, we invited anybody that was involved on the call, including the police, but maybe that was just the area we were with. Jamie, you have a thought on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the challenges is, and I think either Chris or Paul alluded to this, is, you know, on the major incidents, it's easy for management to come in and say, we're going to provide all this support. But, you know, we've talked a lot here on the show about the cumulative stress of, like they said, going, you know, doing the job and going right back to the next call. And it's that cumulative stress over, you know, weeks and months and years that is also damaging in its own way. And it's, you know, development of coping mechanisms that are healthier than others, and hopefully, you know, finding the resources you need when you need them that makes a big difference. And I agree with you, Sam. I think because fire and EMS is closer to the healthcare system because of, you know, patient care and transport, that we I think have a different viewpoint on handling some of these things than probably our law enforcement colleagues do.
That's unfortunate. Becky, this is in your wheelhouse. What do you think?
That I'm not sure I could ever do any of this because of how much I hold on to things. And I think it's just one of those things that before you go into a job, whether it's in law enforcement or, you know, being a first responder, I feel like you really have to understand how you will respond in the moment, but also how you'll cope long term with the things that you may see. I just, hats off to all of you who, you know, put yourselves in these situations every single day, not knowing what's going to occur. And then, you know, continue on. Like, I wasn't sure if it was Chris or Paul, but you just get back in your car and go back to your job. You know, that's tough.
Well, one of the issues we have is those of us that did CISM didn't always take into account our own stress, and you might call it vicarious trauma. But that's another story. Dr. Joe, what do you think?
Well, just kind of reiterating, you know, what folks have already said, I think we all are experiencing stress in different areas. It's part of the job. And there's different sides of the same coin that we're hearing about tonight, and that folks are experiencing those stresses in different sorts of ways, and that it's back to the earlier conversations that we've had about the need to manage and address this chronic stresses on our psyche as we all go through the jobs that we all do.
Right. So, Chris, some of the points you made, too, was that night cops manage the fear and the adrenaline dumps a little bit better. And it's part of the motivation to do the right thing. If somebody else needs you, you need to move on and take care of that. How do you think the night cops do it better? Is it just something that comes with time and experience?
I think that's part of it. I also think that the folks that we call the night police, I think they are a certain breed of person. Most cops will rotate through midnight shifts, and a very small number of those will say, I'm good here, just leave me here, because I like this world. But a lot of folks want to go back to day shift, and they or a swing shift or whatever, and night shifts are different. They're, you know, they're in an odd way, they can be very quiet and lonely and with bursts of, you know, sheer terror. But it takes a different kind of a person, and I think in almost any police department, the guys I've spoken to, the guys that like the night shift are a different breed. And I think that's part of it. Experience is part of it. You know, time on the job is part of it. But it's a different kind of person that likes to work that particular shift after most people have gone to bed and most of the people that are on the street. You know, at 11 o'clock at night, people are getting good and juiced up, drinking, and that's when, you know, as night policemen would say, that's when the fun begins. And so it's generally, you know, you're going balls to the walls from 11 o'clock at night until 3-4 in the morning. And it's a breed of person, I think.
Well, this is when I get to admit I liked being out at night better, much better. It was less routine and more interesting. Well, one of the things I am really interested in, this is my favorite question here, is not that many cities have dual role, police and fire. And in some cases, that, you know, other than being first responders, it seems kind of diametrically opposed in how you think. So as police detectives, you guys were firefighters and apparatus engineers. How does that work? How do you split those shifts? How do you, do the roles conflict? Conflict. You just mentioned something about, gee, they'll give the firefighter a hug, but not the cop. How do you guys deal with that? Paul, you want to start that one?
Well, the agency that we worked for was founded that way. It was started that way as a public safety organization. And it once you got into the specialty fields, like being a detective, you no longer responded to fire stuff. But as patrolmen, we kept our fire turnouts in the trunk of our car. And in some ways, it was a good setup, because there was, what they did was, in the firehouse, there were only enough people to get the fire rigs to the scene. They counted on patrolmen to be the guys that were going to pull hose lines and attack the fire. The guys that were in the firehouse operated the engines and the pumpers and did that part of it. For our agency, it worked because it started out that way from the very beginning. There were certain economies there in terms of the command staff. There was only one chief, not a fire chief or a police chief. There's only one. There's only one dispatch center that handled both sides of things. If you were assigned to the firehouse and you kind of had a patrol mentality, it was tough, but it was kind of self-sorting. Over the years, some guys became specialists in the fire field and other guys kind of became specialists in the police end of things. But yeah, it was interesting.
Well, I can imagine that, you know, as far as investigations, your police skills worked very well as when you're on a fire scene. Right, Chris?
That could be the case. That's true. I just wanted to point out one other thing to Paul's comments is one of the best parts about it, and I don't think public safety concept works everywhere, but in a couple of places in the U.S. where it's been done for a long time, it does work out. The one good aspect to it is that guys that are working the streets after, in reality, it would be generally a few years, they'd get a chance to rotate into the firehouse, and it was a place to de-stress, relax a little bit. And a lot of guys really liked it. I didn't personally. I liked the police side. I wasn't very interested in the fire side. But a lot of guys have said that ability to rotate out and go to the fire side where it wasn't quite so intense every night was beneficial for their mental health.
I can well imagine. And I'm thinking of all these different things. But, you know, going on scene, you know, in a potentially dangerous situation where police aren't there yet, well, police are already with you. So that seems like an added benefit. Dr. Joe, do you have any models like that in Tennessee? Hello, Joe. Mute
button. Yeah, I'm here. Sorry, the mute thing again. Yeah, there's a lot of different models like that out there, and there's a lot of variability in those models as well. And so I think a lot of that has to do with sort of your local relationships, the local milieu of how law enforcement and EMS and fire interact and fit together. And part of that is related to local leadership in both those communities and how well they work together.
Makes sense. Jamie, they have those on the East Coast, especially in the volunteer arena, don't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, in Maryland, most of the rural and even some of the suburban services are at least partially volunteer, if not completely volunteer services. So we have a lot of people that have a multitude of careers. You know, they're firefighters, and EMTs and paramedics, you know, when they're volunteering, and they're also police officers, perhaps professional firefighters somewhere else, or any other profession, you know, pick one. So it's a different type of service. I know here in Maryland, you know, I've worked alongside a lot of the state police officers that I interacted with as a paramedic were the flight medics that, you know, spent 90% of their time picking up trauma patients, and were just some of the most highly trained paramedics I'd ever met. We had a really good relationship with the local first responders, on the fire and EMS side, because, you know, they interacted with them quite a bit, and we learned a lot from them. They took their role seriously as people to, provide training and leadership, from a medical standpoint, as well as being police officers. And so that was an interesting cross-trained role that I had experience with. So I think, like Joe said, there's a lot of different models out there, and you know, if it's what works for your system, if the leadership's on the same page and can get along, it can be very beneficial for all parties.
So Chris, if there's a big MCI or some kind of disaster in the area, which role do you take? Is it whatever you're assigned to do for that day, or is it wherever they feel they need you the most? How would that work?
You're assigned to a division, like you're assigned to fire division or police division, and that's what you work primarily. In the case of a big disaster where they're calling in mutual aid and all of that, you know, the fire guys are going to go in and do their fire role. The police guys are going to have their police role, but if fire needs to be augmented in some way, there are going to be guys in the police division who are fully trained firefighters who can augment the fire services. So it's in a big disaster situation, it's kind of, you know, analogous to mutual aid.
Yeah, within your own city.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of, that gives you a lot more flexibility. That does make sense. Okay, Paul, we're going to talk about, go ahead, Chris.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you, but
No.
For, I would say for most cities, it's not necessarily workable, especially ones that have, you know, been in, had traditional roles forever. And in most cases, all policemen would gladly become a fireman, and no firemen want to be policemen. That's just sort of, I'm speaking obviously in grand generalities, but there's a lot of truth to that. But Sunnyvale, where we came from, they did it from the beginning. Everybody's fully trained. You go to two academies back to back. And then instead of the standard police training, you get that and you get fire training. And, you know, it's happens that sometimes it seems like you're never going to hit the street because all you're doing is training. So it's it's different, and it works for the right city, but not all of them.
Right. So, Paul, I was looking at the material on the book, The Night Police, and you have another one coming up behind it called The Bleeding. But Night Police is defined as a no-holds-barred, unflinching, fictionalized version of real events the authors experienced firsthand during their time in law enforcement. They were dangerous men, and that the Night Police provides truth and insight into the demons behind the badge. And it sounds like there's a bit of definition as real cops going out and drinking after work and stretching the rules. What do you have to say to that?
Well, that was very much the way we did it in those days. We have a lot of terms for it, but oftentimes we talk about the guys that were the night cops and night policemen. They were the swashbucklers. I mean, they would jump from the rafters and do crazy things. And our first book was based on the experiences that Chris and I had, and we lived through some very exciting and unusual times. And there's personal tragedy in the book. A lot of the just the crazy stuff that you do when you're working undercover narcotics. You run a fine line there when you're doing that. It's odd in a lot of agencies. I would be willing to bet. And I mean, you folks come from the medical and that side of it, but in a lot of police agencies, if you ever worked undercover narcotics, there's a certain amount of distrust for the rest of your career because the administration knew you were out there just going buck wild most of the time.
We're being a bad guy.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that makes sense. I always wondered about that, you know, these guys that are undercover for a long
time. And in one of the chapters in the book, I got arrested while I was undercover. Got thrown in jail.
Was that to make it look good, or did they not know you were a cop?
Well, they didn't know I was a cop, and that took some finessing to work my way out from under that.
Oh, God, I can't wait to read that. Chris, what do you have to say about the book?
You know, it's funny. Paul and I, even though we went our separate ways in law enforcement, we had really very parallel events happen to us, and I think they would be parallel in almost any agency. Paul just talked about getting arrested. I got the heck thumped out of me by some cops who found a gun in my boot when I was undercover. They were doing what they were supposed to do, and I was doing what I was supposed to do. But we had a lot of these events that happened in different places that were very similar. And when we talked to other cops in other agencies, the experiences are so translatable. In fact, we get a lot of feedback on Amazon and other places where people have read our book. Yep, I did that. That's exactly what it felt like to me. So it's not unique to us, that's for sure. It was a little bit unique for the times, but our experiences weren't unique to us.
Well, it was probably refreshing for cops to see a book that really laid it out, said, yeah, this is what happens when you're out there doing this kind of work.
It is, and we wrote in our introduction to the book is, look, if you're easily offended, just don't buy the book because we're not politically correct, because cops, at least at that time, were not politically correct, and we tried to write it. We call it the true voice of law enforcement for that period of time we were in it. We just didn't. The only thing we did was we tried to protect names and places and careers and marriages and things like that. But other than that, it's exactly as it happened for us.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Any thoughts, Dr. Joe, as we wind up here?
I can't wait to read it either. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating, and I've so enjoyed the conversation tonight. So looking forward to getting further into this, guys.
Sounds like you need some cold medicine there, Joe. You're sounding a little scratchy. So, Miss Becky, what are your thoughts about learning all of this about cops?
It's just a good perspective to hear after the last year. You know, I think there's always a lot of different sides to stories and the way that media portrays things. And I think it's good to talk to people who, you know, have been doing the job for a long time. So appreciate you guys coming on.
This kind of goes under, if you've not walked in your shoes, you might want to, you know, save your judgment for later. So, Jamie, we learned some stuff tonight, huh?
We certainly did, and it's, I think, important to you know, connect with the police side of the first responder community, maybe a little more frequently here on the show. You know, the disaster response community is broad and encompasses a lot of people and a lot of roles, and we definitely need to be aware and cognizant of everyone that does that job. Wherever direction and whatever career field they're coming from. So I appreciate Paul and Chris coming on tonight. It's really been a pleasure having you gentlemen, and we'll make sure we link to the book in the show notes so that folks can pick it up and take a look for themselves. I'd like to thank our sponsors as well, Dr. Joe and Paragon Medical Education Group. Joe, I know you just got back from doing a round of training with Texas Rangers, so you definitely have had your contact with Paragon in providing unique medical and disaster training for agencies of all types.
Absolutely. And we certainly have included the law enforcement side of that in lots of different ways. So we appreciate both you guys being on with us tonight. And thanks for the contribution, and thanks for all the work that you do.
So, Joe, where can folks find Paragon if they want to take a look at some of the customizable training opportunities and educational things that you can bring to the table?
Sure. Well, we're happy to talk with folks about how we can customize an experience specifically for them. You can find us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com on the web and on Facebook. And you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
Excellent. So, Becky, where can folks find you?
Over on Twitter at WX_Bex, on LinkedIn and Facebook in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Awesome. Chris and Paul, I didn't want to leave you guys out. Is there a website or someplace people can go and look for the book or catch up with the two of you if they have comments and like to share?
Yeah, of course. We have a website. It's nightpolice.com. The book's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual resellers. And we're also, you can find us at The Night Police on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Excellent. Well, I'll make sure folks have links to that as well. Sam, how about you?
Well, you'll find me on social media in a number of places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly on our Disaster Podcast Facebook page and disasterpodcast.com. I also want to put a shout out to the Public Safety Writers Association, of which we are all a member, and it's a great group of people, mostly retired cops, from which I am pulling these awesome guests. So we'll give a shout out to them because I'm sure most of them will be listening to this. What about you, Jamie? Where do we find you?
Well, folks can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. So please friend or follow me or look me up over there. And of course, in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, where we post all of these episodes, as well as our website at disasterpodcast.com. So I hope people will catch up with us in either of those locations. But a good episode, Sam. I'm so glad you brought these two gentlemen on with us this evening and kind of get a look at the a different side of the first responder community.
We'll be having more of that. And thank you, guys. This was an awesome discussion. But my final comment is night cops are not your everyday cops.